everybody. Hello and welcome to Blog Talks Dreamcatcher Entertainment. It is April the 22nd, 2010. I'm your host, Judy Lopez, and with us tonight we have a very special guest. This is author Peter Canova, and he has wrote a magnificent book, and it's called Pope and Elisa, and we're going to bring Peter on in just a second. I just really want to, I'm so happy to be here and get a copy of his book, and I'm looking through it, and it just falls right in line with our women's circle and our women's show, and I just want to hear all about this book, and I recommend it to our listeners out there. Hi, Peter. How are you tonight?
Hello, Judy. How are you? Nice to be with you.
Yes, yes. So, Peter, for our listeners that want you to just bring this book to life, that's what we're going to do tonight. But first, I would like you to tell our listeners a little bit about your background and where you grew up and what inspired you to write this book.
Sure. Well, I grew up in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you could describe me as kind of a restless teenager. I always kind of had a sense that something was a little bit off of the world. I never really felt completely comfortable, so it caused me to become a seeker early in life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in my 20s, something caught my eye in the newspaper, and it was a group that was very popular. I was back in the 70s, so I'm really dating myself here, but it was called Silva Mind Control, and this was a group that taught people how to enhance their extrasensory perception, psychic intuition. You could use different labels for it. What happened was we went through a week of training, and then at the very end of the 1 week, we had a session where we did intuitive medical readings, and you would have one person sit directly opposite you. Everyone kind of went off in a corner in pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And one person would have an index card in front of them. And on the index card would be the name, age, address, and some medical information about a person on the index card. And these were friends or relatives of people who had all graduated through the course. And there had been about 500,000 people who went through this course in the 70s. So there were quite a few index cards stacked up there. But the person who was in possession of the index cards was only allowed to tell you the name, age, and address that they had, no more information. And then they would ask you a simple question, what can you tell me about this person? So the first case I ever did, I remember it very clearly like I did it yesterday, was an elderly gentleman in Miami. And the first thing I was attracted to, I kind of saw an outline of his physical form, and mm-hmm. I was attracted to the area of the heart. Something seemed to catch my senses there. It's not my eyes, but my sensory eyes. And I said to them, well, you know, it looks like something is causing his aorta to be pinched. It looks to me like he has a blockage in his aorta because the heart seemed to be tilted at a funny angle and therefore it was pinching off the aorta. And they said, yes, we have that information here. What else can you tell us? And I kept looking and I saw something that looked metallic down in the bottom quadrant of the heart. And I said, well, it appears to me like he may have had a pacemaker installed. And they said, yes, that's correct. We have that information. What else? And they then asked me, well, what year did he have the pacemaker installed? So I saw the hands of a clock spinning around in my mind, just kind of like wildly flailing around. And all of a sudden it stopped quickly at the number at 10 o'clock, which in my mind indicated to me 10 years. So it was 1975 at the time. And I said, I believe the pacemaker was installed in 1965. And they said, that's correct. So I went on to do a succession of these, and I found I did them with a lot of clarity. And I went home that night, and I probably slept for the first time peacefully, because I realized, you know, the thought came to me, if I'm able to get this information, it must mean that we are all connected at an unseen level. There has to be an energy, there has to be a mind, a consciousness that's interpenetrating all of us that we can tap into, and that there's a common source out there that we can go to for guidance, that we can go to for information, but even more importantly, that binds us together as spiritual energy beings. And that was a realization, because a lot of us talk about this in theory and we talk about it intellectually, but when you actually have an experience like that, and then you keep on having experiences like that. I started to do medical readings for people in the neighborhood, and before I knew it, I had, you know, a block long of people waiting outside my door for medical readings. And when you keep doing them successively like this, it becomes an experience. It goes beyond the realm of an intellectual proposition. It becomes a real experience. So you go from, let's say, faith and belief in these things, and you graduate to knowledge of the fact that it really is true because you've experienced it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You have quite the background. I was reading earlier, and I was like, wow, he does have, you did, so they were medical readings. And tell our listeners out there a little bit about your wife. I thought that was very touching, and I liked that part about your...
When my wife was ill, you mean?
Yes, I love that part.
Well, yeah, that was part of the process in the creation of the book. After I, just to pick up, I'll get to that, and then right after I started doing the medical readings, when I started going into the working world, I traveled all over the world, and I went around four continents, and I started meeting people who would literally just come up to me in the street and say, oh, you're the boy who can do some strange things, and they'd be talking to me. There's a variety of shamans and gurus in India and shamans in Africa, whatever, and I came back, and I always had, I guess, the seeds of writing in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a very intense business. We were in luxury real estate hotel development business all around the globe, not something very related to what I'm doing now, but I guess I secretly always wanted to write. So while I was on the airplane, I used to write little snippets of things. The idea of this book came to me in a screenwriting class, and I worked on it over a period of 10 years off and on as time allowed because my job was so time-consuming. But my wife became ill with breast cancer, and I stopped work for almost a year to stay home and take care of her. And during that time, it was a very emotional time, as you could probably imagine. So the psychic energy that was pouring through me was intense. I literally would burn out. I burned out half a dozen computers just by sitting in their proximity, to the point where people wouldn't invite me in their houses anymore if they had an expensive computer around. And I burnt out about half a dozen of my own. And I was getting a lot of channeled information during that time. And that really propelled the book along. Many of much of the content of the book was developed from that period in my life when I was helping my wife. And I think that it shows me that emotion, which is more of a feminine quality, is the fuel that we use to reach these perceptions, whereas, logic, the male side, may be the guidance system because we can formulate an idea of what we want to do. But just because you have an idea that you want to do something doesn't mean you'll get there without the emotion and the desire to do it. So the desire to help and the desire to be helpful and healing at that time was very strong in me, and I think that propelled a lot of the writing of the book during that period.
That is just amazing, that you say that. And it's almost as if this Pope Annalisa is a real person. Can you tell us a little bit about Pope Annalisa herself? And is she a real person?
Well, it seemed that way sometimes. I think in many ways, and probably a lot of writers might tell you this, when I actually wrote it and I sat down and I looked at it several times, I said, wow, I really think that she's a composite of my sub-personalities and some of people that I've known, certainly, but a lot of my own personality aspects were in there. So I think it's a combination of, people I met through experience and just aspects of myself coming out. But Pope Annalisa, the book is really two stories. It's a thriller. It's set in the near future about a miracle-working African nun, and it's a world where resources of oil and water are scarce. Iran has gone nuclear, and there's friction between great powers that's close to boiling over to war. And Annalisa is down there in Africa. She comes out of nowhere performing healings outside control of the church. And some Muslims in Nigeria are converting because of her healing. So she's upsetting the power structure of both the Catholic Church and the Islamic terrorists in Nigeria. Now, Nigeria is a country where I lived for several years, and one of the reasons I chose that country is because it's the most populous country in Africa. It's about half Muslim and half Christian, about equally divided, and it has always been sort of the front line of tensions and violent outbreaks between the two world outlooks or religious viewpoints. So she's upsetting the apple cart down there, and there's also in the story a body of Catholic prophecy that's predicted the rise of a great heretic who's going to destroy the church from within and lead the world order to ruin. So there's a lot of suspicion about her on the part of the hierarchy of the church. And then through a stunning series of events, beginning with her healing the Pope, who's severely ill, she is taken into the church. She rises to become a cardinal. And when the Pope dies. I won't reveal to spoil the plot line of the book, but a very, very extraordinary event occurs in the Sistine Chapel when they're electing the new pope, and it results in her being elected pope. And then everything sort of heats up after that. Demonic symbols begin appearing around the Vatican. She reverses 2,000 years of Catholic traditions. America goes to war with Iran in the Middle East, and everything is just on the verge of going nuclear. So now people are looking at her and saying, "Wow, is she is she the builder or the destroyer? Is she the cure or the cause for this harsh new world?" Uh-huh. And that's sort of the storyline. But there's a parallel story going on here, what I call the second story, the one behind the scenes. And this story explores a lost spiritual tradition that was once strong or even prevalent among ancient Christians and Jews and most of the peoples in the Middle East and the Mediterranean basin. And it was a universal spiritual wisdom. It was feminine in nature. It was in rhythm. It was feminine in character, and it was in rhythm with nature. It was pretty much found, this spiritual wisdom was a thread that was pretty much found running through all the ancient cultures and religions of the world, whether they're the modern ones we know today, Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, or the ancient mystery schools like the Oracle in Delphi and all the mystery schools in Egypt. It was a common thread that stressed intuition to balance logic, heart to balance mind, and experience to balance faith. And it posed a different view of human beings as co-participants or even co-creators of a divine evolutionary process. So it was a very profound wisdom knowledge. And these ancient seers that were the proponents of this tradition just came up with incredible insights into not only the psychological workings of the human mind, but they really anticipated a lot of modern scientific discoveries, particularly in quantum physics, which I can elaborate on later on, but it's just absolutely stunning how at a subjective level they came back with these truths that are now being borne out by modern scientific instruments. So this whole spiritual story, as it evolved through Christianity, is bound with the suppressed role of women in the church, Mary Magdalene, and the whole idea of unifying our own fragmented psyches by balancing our male and female energies to produce a more whole and aware human being.
Mm-hmm. That, and it's, you know, amazing how, from looking at the website itself, how you incorporate female pope. I mean, she's a lady of color. She's a strong spiritual woman in general. I mean, it just kind of rocks the whole world as we know it today. And I love that, and we love that. We love the rise of women, strong women. And does this come from somewhere deep, maybe even you reading your past, a reading of sorts, so what you see coming up? And what you see happening with women today, or it's almost as if you're seeing something that's fixing to happen.
Well,
when you read the book, of course you do. You're a believer.
Well, what I'm a believer in is that energies must balance themselves, or we destroy ourselves. And for so long, the world has been dominated by a patriarchal culture. Now, it was not always that way. We go through cyclical periods. Mm-hmm. The goddess and Earth Mother worship was very prevalent before these patriarchal religions and cultures pretty much destroyed it. And the Christian, Orthodox Christianity, I should say, because there were other branches of Christianity that weren't like this, but Orthodox Christianity had much to do with destroying that ancient feminine spiritual wisdom. So what I see is the scales now coming into balance again, and hopefully they don't go from one extreme to the other. I think what we're going to see in this, I don't like to use the term new age because it's become kind of pejorative now, but hopefully what we see in this coming age is that these qualities that were represented, the heartfelt, the intuition, the heartfelt thinking rather than brain-based thinking, these feminine qualities of creativity will balance with the male qualities of rational, logical, linear thinking, and so forth, again, to produce a more balanced type of human being. And I just see that happening all over the place. When I started, Mary Magdalene plays a role in my book, in my trilogy. Mm-hmm. And when I started about 10 years ago researching this, there were a, sort of, I found a few other people or books or things around the internet discussing the subject of Mary Magdalene, but it was still pretty obscure at the time. There's just been an explosion of interest in the figure of Mary Magdalene, and I just simply think that that's symbolic. I don't necessarily think it's Mary Magdalene per se, but I see that as the crest of a wave of this rediscovering the value of this feminine energy, which incidentally, I don't want any of the viewers, particularly the men out there, to mistake this. By feminine energies, these are energies that we all possess. We all, as individuals, whether we're a man or a woman, possess masculine and feminine qualities or energies within us. It's all a matter of balance and, you know, which is more dominant. So when I speak of these, I'm talking about unleashing psychic and other energies within ourselves in order to transform our inner worlds, which in turn transform the outer world. But I see that rising wave of that feminine side rising to balance what we've been facing for so many years.
Yes, and that's so true, because that great spirit, the feminine side, the mother to us all, she comes in and just comforts us. And then you have the creator, for me, as the masculine, and he make sure that we're being the police of Mother Earth, you know, making sure we're doing everything the right way. And I really like, I just feel this book, you know, will empower any reader, any woman reader out there, and a man too. But the universal spiritual tradition, that you have in here, it underlines, I mean, all major religions, and just a little taste of a lot of earth-based old ways that are now coming, hopefully coming back, and we want to, as women, rise. So, again, your book is just right on time, and we also do a book study, and it talks about clan mothers, and we do that once a month. And Looks Far Woman is the clan mother of this month. So, in reality, Annalisa, Pope Annalisa might be Looks Far Woman as our clan mother of the month.
It's very interesting, Judy, to talk about this, because I know your show deals with a lot of indigenous American topics or slants that way. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some really strong parallels between Annalisa and the experience of the indigenous cultures. Because Annalisa, one of the reasons that I set the whole story in Africa, besides the fact that I was familiar when I lived there, is that in Africa, they still have very strong forms of what you would call native traditions animist or natural worship or natural religions outside of Christianity and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the book, Annalisa presents an interesting paradox. Annalisa is raised more or less by a shaman, but then, at the same time, she comes under the wing of a German Catholic nun.
Uh-huh.
So that, like the experience of many Native Americans who must have faced, let's say, Christianity as opposed to their own indigenous religions,
right,
Annalisa is caught between these two worlds, the sort of, you know, rational, thinking or outlook of the strict outlook of the church at that time, and then the more earth-based indigenous religions. And it's really funny, because for the first time today I had an insight. I said, you know, why did I make that nun a German nun? Well, I think I probably made her a German nun. It just came to me. I think I probably made her German because of all the representatives of Western culture and sort of like the patriarchal side, you know, that tough side of Western culture, who's more representative of that than the
you
Germans?
You had to throw the German in.
Yeah, I had to throw the German in. So, but, you know, Annalisa, just like indigenous Americans, is caught between that world and the type of Christianity that she brings to the church, that a lot of it causes a lot of upset, is partly based in the fact that it is closer to nature, and it's not encumbered by all these sophisticated dogmas and rituals and doctrines that were developed by the church over the year that really stand between people and God. She cuts through a lot of that.
Yeah,
and of course,
like going back to her,
Europeans don't understand it very well.
By just going probably back to her roots and her DNA of who she is as a woman, and you find it in practicing and in religion itself, you feel and you tap into your own ancestral realm, whether through dream time or whatnot, and I can see her practicing her nature-based, her, you know, beautiful high priestess self, probably behind closed doors.
In a manner of speaking, not in terms of what you would think the standard rituals are of mm-hmm. that, but it's really, she is really an archetypical person. She is an archetype of something universal within all of us that I think is crying to be heard right now and has been suppressed for a long time. And yes, that is feminine in nature. It is intuitive in nature. It is very creative in nature. It does get to the heart of our reality and our existence, sweeping aside a lot of the intellectual constructs that the church and other institutions have forced on us.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, what you're saying is correct.
Yay, because I feel her. And I bet you didn't know you would be on too with another one like yourself. But, you know, it kind of goes with the whole creating of the show and how I started out is I just like to hear about all different types of practices and found out that they're all indigenous from North America, South America, all the way up to Canada and around our Great Turtle Island is pretty much nature-based. And we're all so similar. So this Pope, your Pope Annalisa, just really brings that out. So what makes your Pope Annalisa, this book, different from any other thrillers out there?
Well, I think the fact that, like any other thriller out there, mm-hmm. you have characters, and the characters are caught in conflicts, and the characters must make choices. And in the end, the characters must make decisions that are going to have a wide-reaching impact on the world. But in the case of Pope Annalisa, those decisions, the life-changing decisions that come out at the end of the book, are not made on a political or social or economic basis like you would find in most thrillers, but they're
yeah.
done from a spiritual place.
I like that.
By the same token, everybody that picks up the book says, this is a page-turner. You know, it's not a dull, preachy,
no.
Spiritual tome by some, you know, obscure person in the basement who's trying to promote, you know, their new vision of spirituality. It's really something that you experience, you live and breathe it through the characters. It's not a, you know, it's not a nonfiction self-help spiritual book, of which there's a lot of other people doing that better than I am out there. I wanted to write about spiritual themes in a form that not many people are doing today, which is a fictional form. Although fiction based on 25 years of research and substantial facts in here.
Oh, yes. I can read, and what I did read, it tells a lot about the author and also about his gifts. So for our listeners out there who want to know, Peter, what qualifies you to write on this subject, on this type of it? It is pretty racy.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that what qualifies me to write on this is the fact that, at least on the spiritual issues that I'm dealing with,
mm-hmm.
first of all, there's a lot of research involved in it. I speak Greek, so I was able to read a lot of the lost text that this spiritual wisdom comes out of, partially in ancient Greek and partially English translations. And I conducted a lot of research, not only book research, but personal research as I traveled around the world into the themes and the topics that went with this, met a lot of people who were practicing various forms of this spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the real cutting difference, though, is instead of it being something I'm writing about, it's also something that I've lived. I've had these experiences through my meditations. A good part of this book was channeled information that came through me, you know, in addition to those things that I just book learned. And as I said earlier in the show, the difference between having faith or taking these things as an intellectual proposition and actually having experienced them or lived through them is the difference between faith and knowledge. You graduate from faith to knowledge when you have an experience that says, okay, I've internalized this because I've experienced it. Now I know it's real. I don't just think it's real.
Yes. That's a good answer. Yes, yes. So Pope Annalisa, is that a takeoff from the Da Vinci Code?
Well, a lot of people sort of think that because
you're Mary Magdalene.
Well, yeah, Mary Magdalene, and it deals with spiritual secrets, and there's, you know, mm-hmm. there's secret orders of the Catholic Church involved. And I'll tell you something very funny. I know Dan Brown. He bought some homes from us at one of our developments that we have, and I kind of joke with him that I wrote my book earlier, but he got his out first because he's been an established author, and I'm still a struggling one. But there are only superficial similarities. They're really very different books. Mm-hmm. On the Mary Magdalene issue, I'll give you an example of how different they are. In Dan's book, Mary Magdalene, the whole theory behind Dan's book is the old bloodline theory, which is that Jesus and Mary had children.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary Magdalene is pictured as the Holy Grail in the book and the movie, as the Holy Grail, meaning she is the receptacle of Jesus' children. Well, in my trilogy, Mary Magdalene is also the Holy Grail, but she's the receptacle of something very different. Not the receptacle of Jesus' children, because honestly, whether or not they had children, I don't think has any bearing on anything, and it doesn't really change anything for anybody. I think the more important thing is that Mary Magdalene very likely was the receptacle of the secret oral tradition, which Jesus represented a link through from ancient times and was transmitting to the world of his age.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily on an oral basis, because in the Bible it tells us that Jesus taught to the masses in parables, but unto the disciples he gave the real secrets. And the Gospels that were discovered in Egypt in 1945, the Nag Hammadi Gospels, also known as the Gnostic Gospels, paint a very different picture of early Christianity and mm-hmm. the role of Mary Magdalene. In fact, Mary Magdalene was pictured as Jesus' foremost disciple rather than Peter. In fact, Peter was kind of pictured as a dunce who didn't really get it. And Mary was Jesus' primary disciple and the one who really understood the core or the essence of the transmission of the sacred knowledge that he was imparting to the disciples. So she was considered by that group of Christians even a co-equal of Christ. She was considered a manifestation of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting the role she played and how she and other women in the church got written out of history as Christianity came to be one of the competing religions to be the state religion of the Roman Empire. Well, the way they got successful was they got rid of the women because women were an embarrassment back then. You couldn't be a major religion if most of your bishops or leaders or whatever were
okay.
women. It was just a patriarchal world. So they gradually pushed the women aside, rewrote the Gospels and everything to play down their role or even eliminate their role. And when they became the state church under Constantine, that whole process of patriarchal dominance and the hierarchical structure just continued on.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So the book, it says here, Jesus and other prophets, there was secret teachings. So there's secret teachings in your book?
Well, we can't be 100% sure what exactly was taught on an oral basis back then, because most of what was committed to writing was destroyed by the Orthodox Catholic Church. Christianity had two major streams in its early days, what became known as the Orthodox version of Christianity and the Gnostic version of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Gnostic comes from the Greek word to know. The Gnostics were considered knowers. What did they know? The Gnostics were the people I told you about who were the mystic seers who used their spiritual powers and their psychic powers to penetrate higher dimensions and bring back information. And the information they brought back was quite startling. I'll go into some of the parallels between what they saw in modern science a little bit later
sure.
in the show. But they brought back some incredible wisdom. And the Gnostics actually predated Christianity. They were part of this ancient spiritual tradition that we've mentioned. And that tradition, let me just tell you, let me fill you in a little bit more about this tradition so we're not too nebulous about it. It has a lot of permutations, so it doesn't always lend itself to one, you know, overarching definition, but we can touch on some of its attributes. For one thing, it's a spiritual wisdom. It's not a religion. It's a spiritual orientation that runs through nearly every religion in some form, and a very abbreviated description would tell us that human beings are physical entities containing projections of God's own spiritual essence. Now, this means that humans are actually expressions of the infinite in finite form here on earth for the purpose of evolving God's consciousness into matter. Now, this is opposed to the traditional Western religious or Orthodox Catholic views that humans were created in Latin ex nihilo, or out of nothing, like little lumps of clay who were somehow granted life force. There's a huge difference between saying that you essentially contain a spark of the divine itself, as opposed to saying that you're just a creation of the divine, and that you're something that is somehow apart from the divine, and you were created separately. They did not envision humans as a separate creation. They envisioned humans as a flowing or projections of God's essence himself into material experience. So, you know, humans were kind of viewed as spiritual vibration slowed down and condensed into solid forms, almost like a holograph represents the true underlying reality, that a human being is a hologram, and our world is really a holographic projection of an underlying reality. And it's kind of really cool, because you think about, remember Star Trek and the old holodeck?
Oh, yes, and the Matrix.
Right, and the Matrix. So, you know, you go into the holodeck, and you experience a virtual reality that's almost indistinguishable from real reality, and if you're not careful, you can kind of forget where you are, and that becomes your reality. Well, that's what this tradition said happened to human beings, that the world that spirit projected itself into was kind of overwhelmed by the denseness of materiality, and we as spirits began identifying with more and more with the body and forgetting, you know, our spiritual nature. And you mentioned The Matrix. The Matrix was a great movie. I mean, what The Matrix was all about was essentially unplugging yourself from that, you know, illusion of reality and seeing the true underlying reality, you know, beneath. And this is exactly what this spiritual tradition was teaching everybody way back, 2,000, 4,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the genesis of what underlies everything we're talking about here when we talk about this wisdom tradition or this feminine spiritual tradition.
I do. I love how you put that in words, and it reminds me of my teacher who comes on the Women's Circle and some other programs here on Dreamcatcher Entertainment, and he talks about the holograms. He talks about just what you just said about we're here in the physical trying to have we're in the spirit trying to have a physical experience and things that we go through. And just as you said, the programs of the government, and it gets very political, but everything is right on time with our show and what we talk about on a weekly basis. So can you tell our listeners out there, and this is your show, so I'm going to stay on track, what is the first Soul Trilogy? Tell me about that.
Well, Pope Annalisa is the first book in a trilogy called The First Souls.
Okay.
The First Souls is pretty much what it says. It's about the first souls to incarnate in material experience. It's about those souls that led the fall of spirit from the higher dimensions into material experience. And it traces the lives of those seminal or archetypical souls over different epochs of history. The first portion of that is covered in Pope Annalisa. Successive parts of the story are covered in the second book, The 13th Disciple, and the final book, which is called The Light of Distant Suns.
And all three of these are done? They're already printed out?
Well, Pope Annalisa is out. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do a crass and shameless plug for my book.
Yes!
Yeah, thank you for that segue. The publication date is June 1st, and it will be available through all major bookstores at that time. There currently, I did a test market paperback version, which is right now available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com online, but the hardcover version will be available by June 1st. I think I also have a limited number of books, hardcover books, available through my website, PopeAnnalisa.com. But the 13th Disciple is... I've got substantial portions of it written. I have not started on the third book yet. The marketing, I'll tell you, Judy, the marketing of the first book is probably, I knew it was going to be tough, but it's such a full-time job that literally it's not leaving me a lot of time right now to complete the second book. So maybe with the help of your listeners today, if I start getting some sales here over the next year, I'll be able to devote a little bit more time to finishing off the second book.
Yes, yes. Wow, I just like the way it's put together. And again, tell me about the front cover. What inspired you for the artwork on the cover of the book? That's beautiful.
Yeah, interesting question. It was a vision that I had. And it's funny the way things work out, but more often than not, things do work out this way. I searched the internet for graphic designers, and I came up with a young guy who wasn't even really a graphic designer. He was an architect, or at least he was a student studying to be an architect. And he was still going to architectural school, kind of a struggling student. And I told him what I wanted. I had this vision. I pretty much described it to him the way you see it in the cover. And he went out and got some images, and it just hit it to a T. For the folks who haven't seen it, the front cover depicts a lovely African-American woman in a simple nun's robe with a cross on, kind of looking with her eyes closed up to the heavens. She looks like she's got one foot in this world and one foot out of this world. In the top background on either side of her, you see two eyes, one in fire and one in more of the clouds. And then right underneath that, you see two sets of images, one of Islamic terrorists and the other of some of the Western soldiers that are opposing them. It's a juxtaposed image where she is superimposed over this background because the fire and the sky symbolizes the fact that throughout most of the book, we don't know, and I'm not going to tell you, whether she's a force for good or evil, if she's the destroyer, if she's the creator. And mm-hmm. most people throughout the book, even her closest associates, are wondering that. And that's what that implies. And, of course, the earthly part of that conflict is between Islamic terrorism and the West is depicted in the symbols with the soldiers and the terrorists on it. And she is superimposed over those images, like I say, with almost looking like she has one foot out of this world and one foot in it, with a very striking expression on her face. So that was the impetus behind the book. And this young guy just hit it on the head the first time out. And he later told me, you know, I'm sorry, I'm too busy studying to be a student. I can't really do this job for you. But I kind of took the template that he gave picture-wise and, you know, put the shoot together. I brought up a model from New York, and we spent about 6 hours, and we did the front cover shoot. But that's the genesis of that front cover.
Oh, that's just beautiful. And she is a very beautiful and intriguing woman. The eyes, the blue eyes, tell me about that. Whose eyes are those?
We don't know.
Oh.
We don't know.
Okay.
We don't know. It's. I think I want to leave that for everybody to.
I knew there was something to those eyes.
Superimpose their own answer on that question.
I said those are not Peter's eyes. I looked.
No, they're not. I have no graphic representation on the front cover.
Okay. How does Pope Annalisa treat Christianity, Catholicism, and then the Christian stories in general?
Yeah,
in a nice way. Is she for or against?
Well, again, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but let me say first of all that this is not...
You can be general.
This is not a Catholic book. Mm-hmm. For those that are listening out there, because it centers around the Pope and the Catholic Church, that is a vehicle to tell a universal story that anybody can read and enjoy and understand. So this is not a book that's strictly for Catholics. On the other hand, it's not a book that really should alienate Catholics. In fact, one of the it was very interesting. I saw one of the reviews on Amazon.com, which have all been unbelievably good reviews.
Oh, yeah.
And it was from a gentleman who said, you know, when I told my friends, he's a Catholic, and he said, when I told my Catholic friends about this story about a female pope, at first they were horrified, you know, how could a woman become pope? And he went on to say that, you know, I really enjoyed this story because in the context of the story, everything is believable, and it's not a book that really, you know, should offend Catholics.
Mm-mm.
There's a lot of church bashing books and movies out there. The Catholic Church in particular is a popular target. And look, the Christianity has done its number in the world just as almost every other religion has. You know, everybody's taken their turns in different epochs and ages. You know, Islam is prominent right now. Christianity, especially back in the Middle Ages and with, you know, over in the New World and everything, did some terrible things. I think any people who are adherents of any religion can be accused at some point in history of having done some bad things. But, you know, there is a lot of church bashing going on right now. This is not a church bashing book because there's a different focus to this. This is really about spirit transcending religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole message of this book, so that when you see this figure of Annalisa, she doesn't do whatever she does from without. she decides whatever she is going to do, and I'll leave that for the readers to read about, but whatever she's going to do is done within the church. And my own personal view of religion is that, especially with the three Abrahamic religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, there's a lot of flaws in these religions. But the interesting thing is, we talked about this universal spiritual tradition. Each of them has it. Unfortunately, Christianity did the best job of destroying their inner mystical core. But if you look at the Sufis in Islam, the Kabbalists in Judaism, and the Gnostics in Christianity, those three groups were the inner mystical cores of their outer religions. The Kabbalah in Judaism, the Sufis in Islam, the Gnostics in Christianity, these were the mystical inner cores. And these three inner cores have more in common with each other than they actually have with their own outer religions, because, again, the thread, that universal spiritual thread, is what binds them together. The same religious and wisdom tradition binds them together. But each of those mystical cores, unfortunately, it seems to be the nature of the world that prophets speak the heart of God, but their followers start religions. And everything that started off as a revealed word ended up becoming institutionalized and, of course, subject to all the egos and the power trips and the hierarchies and the superstructures. So we get religions that are competing against one another, causing a lot of grief and everything else, but they all started usually with a spiritual core. So what this book does is it tries to go back to the spiritual core, particularly of Christianity, and talk about it, and it views the Orthodox religion we have as maybe, you know, spirituality 101, the stepping stone that gives you some of the concepts and ideas that will allow you to go on to the next step of a deeper spiritual journey.
I see. And would you mind if I let our listeners hear some of the reviews?
No, please.
Of your book? Okay. This one, this is Adam Marsh, editor, literary agent. He says, an epic thriller captivating from beginning to end. Pope Annalisa compels readers to contemplate their own notions of spirituality, good and evil, power and justice, in the manner of the best literary fiction. So, I mean, in reading the reviews and looking at what I've looked at, fiction, yes, but I can really, really say that there is a lot of truth with a lot of the parts of it. It's somebody's, she is a person, and she's many. Does that make sense? She's one, and then she's many.
Yes.
Okay, here's another one.
Because, like I say, we're dealing with archetypes here, and archetypes really are universal representations of what's in all of us.
Love it, love it. Here's one by P. Herbert, and he gives a review on Amazon.com. It says, Peter Canova is brilliant in his awesome presentation of World Crisis. This is a must-read and hopefully a movie soon. Wow, a movie soon! I'm going to ask you about that in a second. This book has power to change lives. So what do you think about if you were asked to do a movie about this book? Wow, that would be such an opportunity.
Well, you know, that seems to be, I'm pleased that that seems to be a common reaction. A number of the reviews have said, can't wait to see it as a movie. It does, you know, if you read it, and I know you're just into it now, but if you read it, it really does lend itself to a big Hollywood epic movie because it's a big epic book. It's in fact, I think it's probably one of the few modern spiritual epics that we've had around in the last several decades. So, yeah, sure. I mean, I'm a film fan. I think if it were done properly, and I'd like to see it treated respectfully, I think it could be great. You know, when I read Lord of the Rings, and I was fascinated with it when I was in my 20s, and I said to myself, I just pray to God that when they make a movie out of this, they don't make it like a cartoon because of the fantastic elements in it, because behind that myth, and, you know, myth is not fantasy. Real myths that we've been handed down in the Native American cultures, in the European cultures, if you really understand them and examine what they are symbolic language for higher truth that may give us more of a perspective than our actual religions do on what the real nature of reality and human beings are. So the Lord of the Rings was an incredible myth that spoke about a lot of things, and I instinctively recognized that as a young guy, and I said, when they make a movie, please don't make it like Hollywood cartoonish Conan the Barbarian type of thing. And thankfully, I kissed the ground that when Peter Jackson made that movie, he did such a magnificent job. If someone did the same justice to my book that they did to Lord of the Rings, I'd be a happy guy.
I like that answer. Thank you. Thank you for that. So, Peter, for others out there that are listening and those who are interested in your book, how can one get a hold of you for an interview or just to chit-chat with you about your book or maybe touch on some areas that I wasn't able to? How can one get a hold of you?
Well, several ways. I'm on Twitter under the name Pope Annalisa. And for any of you folks on Twitter, you can always send me messages there. I'm on the incidentally, that's spelled, let me spell that for you. It's spelled PopeAnnalisa, all one word. Just like the website is popeannalisa.com, my name on Twitter is Pope Annalisa. And I am on the Jason Network, which incidentally, Judy, I don't know if you or your listeners know about that. It's a terrific I guess you'd call it almost like a Facebook network for spiritually minded people. Wonderful
uh-huh.
network. And it's called the Jason Network. I'm on there. I can be reached through there. I'm on another website called Scriblerati. Oh, God, I'm going to have to spell that now. Scriblerati. And I'm also on Scriblerati, both the Jason Network and that one under my name, Peter Canova. On the website, there is a contact button that you can press on there to send me emails, and those are some good ways to get in touch with me if people have any questions.
And there's also your publicist?
I have a publicist, Sherry Rosen Publicity,
mm-hmm.
and she is located in New York City.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome. And you can go to www.sherryrosen.com. And go through her as well. And that's what I did. So can you just tell our listeners, and if you don't have it in front of you, what announcement they made in New York on April the 19th, 2010?
It was great. I had a major piece of news.
Yes,
Pope
you did.
Pope Annalisa won 2 Nautilus Awards. The Nautilus Awards are one of the most difficult awards because they have 3 levels of judging by book professionals of all stripes all
mm-hmm.
over the country, and you have to go through three layers of judging.
Mm-hmm.
Pope Annalisa has gone through 2 of those and won 2 of the awards. I've won 2 silver awards for visionary fiction and for spirituality. Now the book is on to the gold medal round, which will be announced in at Book Expo in New York on May 26th. So it's won the 2 silvers, and it's in the running for the gold there. But from what I'm understanding, I guess this was a self-published book, and I've been hearing that it's very unusual for a self-published book to win an award like this. Just to give you an idea, some of the people who have won this award in the past, Eckhart Tolle, the Dalai Lama, Barbara Kingsolver, Deepak Chopra, Mariel Hemingway.
Oh.
The list kind of goes on. Francis Moore-Lappay.
And I love Gary Zuwick.
Carolyn Mace. If you look at the if you go to the Nautilus book website, they have a list of all the past winners, and it's pretty much a who's who of best-selling authors and outstanding people in the writing field. So it was really quite an honor, and I was very humbled and pleased about it. Thank you.
Well, I'm not surprised. It's so well put together. And reading the book, if you don't know Peter, when you get done reading the book, you will know Peter. Because like you said, you know, when you write, it is, you say it comes to you intuitively. It comes to you maybe through dream time and through past experiences. And then, of course, your foundation of how you were raised. And what you learn through books, and it's just so well. And I see Joel Osteen's Houston's own Joel Osteen is also on that list.
Oh, yes, right. He is from the. Yes, he is. He is on that
yes.
list.
Correct. Yes, right here in Houston. And I just wanted to tell our listeners out there that we really appreciate Peter you coming on the show. And our time is up. now, but I welcome you back in the future. And is there anything you wanted to say in closing?
I just want to say thank you for having me on. I hope your listeners enjoyed the show. I know I enjoyed talking with you, and maybe I'll be back again sometime. Thank you.
Oh, yes, you will definitely be back again, because we want to hear more about Pope Annalisa, and I know you're going to get a movie deal, and that's Intuitively Speaking.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And I just wanted to thank again our listeners out there on Blog Talk Streamcatcher Entertainment.